all of you who have been following along in our walk through Genesis, our very slow walk through Genesis, know that we're at the point of the flood. We were going to talk about this last week, and I ran out of time because I tried to tackle too much. So we're going to take a look at the flood of Noah this week, and the next week we will start with the life of Abraham. The key thing to remember when you look at this passage about the ark is that the ark is the church. The first symbol of Christianity that was adopted by the apostles and the early Christians was not the cross. It was not even the fish that we like to put on our trunks. It was the anchor. Because the church viewed themselves as the ark, as those chosen by God for salvation in the midst of a world that was plunging into destruction. And this is particularly appropriate when you consider the time and the history in which the early church was being established. The church only existed in Jerusalem for 40 years before Jerusalem was completely destroyed. The Roman army came through and they stripped the land of all the trees, building up these massive woodworks around the walls and burned them so hot that the limestone rocks in which the city walls were built melted and just collapsed to the ground. Jesus prophesied in the Gospel of Luke, that not one stone would be left upon another. And indeed, the whole city was just completely leveled through destruction and through fire. However, we learn from early church historians that the church, the group, the Christians who lived in Jerusalem were warned prophetically about the coming of the destruction. Of course, we also see the warning in Luke by Jesus. And they fled into modern-day Syria to escape the destruction that occurred in Jerusalem. And there they remained until recently, when ISIS has begun destroying these Christians who have lived there since the late 1st, early 2nd century. And that's why when you read the news about these ancient churches that are being destroyed, many of these churches go all the way back to the 2nd century AD, where they were built by these Christians who fled the destruction of Jerusalem. But the church saw itself as the ark, as this collection of people who were being saved through baptism. We saw in the reading from the Epistle of Peter that Cheryl read that the church understood that this event of Noah's ark was the prefigure of baptism. Because in the flood, the waters destroyed all the unrighteous of the earth. But the righteous were saved. And the same water that destroyed the unrighteous saved the righteous. For it was the water that floated the ark, that gave buoyancy to the ark, and so that the righteous were saved through the water that also destroyed the unrighteousness. And this has always been the idea, the concept of baptism, that baptism washes us of our uncleanness and restores us to that pure relationship with God. It restores us to the relationship of God that Adam and Eve enjoyed in the garden. So we're kind of coming full circle here, where we see, you know, we read about paradise, the fall, man becomes a murderer, and God brings destruction to the earth, but he saves the elect, he saves the remnant, he saves those who are righteous, and then through baptism, which is being prefigured here, he restores them to the relationship that they have in the garden. Now you see a few interesting elements in the story, those of you who have read it. One is that God says he's going to shorten man's life. We talked a little bit last week about how long these people lived in these genealogies of the Old Testament. You know, 800 years, 900 years, and although they're much shorter than the annals of the Assyrian kings, it's still this enormous lifespan. But God says that he's not going to contend with man forever, and he's going to limit man's lifespan to 120 years. And we read a lot of odd things in these passages. The sons of men fall in love with the daughters of the earth. The sons of God fall in love with the daughters of earth, right? And we start with that. We talked a little bit last time in our fellowship hour, our snack time, about how there were other hominids on the earth, that there was mankind in whom there was a spiritual nature, but there were other human-like creatures, such as the Neanderthals and the Peking man and the Francis man and others that they're discovering, that did not enjoy the spiritual relationship with God that man enjoyed. They were truly, purely animals. They didn't have that spiritual spark. And apparently in this time period, and in fact, we know genetically that mankind and Neanderthals, at least, did interbreed. They had interaction with one another. And currently, most Europeans are about 4% Neanderthal. Africans, only about 1 or 2%, because the Neanderthals didn't move that far south. But there, we get all these little historical facts that we're discovering, largely through the field of genetics. But then, you know, we see these hints of them in the scriptures. This gives us some glimpse of the historical accuracy of scriptures. That they're, like I say, this is not history in the sense that we think about history, but they're ancient memories. They're ancient memories that man had. By the time this is being written down, again, it's about 1000 BC, there are these little remnants of memory of the history of mankind that are getting recorded. And they're recorded here in a much purer form than I have ever found anywhere. And I've read a lot of ancient documents, a lot of ancient mythologies, a lot of ancient histories, and nowhere do you see this this purity that we see in Genesis. Even though, like I said, we're not taking it literally, we're not saying that they're sons of God, they're daughters of earth, and then they're interbreeding, and in the Middle Ages they said that they were breeding demons, and then we're not trying to look at it in some kind of a literal way, but we're still saying that there is a historical purity to this record that is very, very unique in all of the historical records that we have. And then there's this mention of the Nephilim, who are the offspring of these of the men and women that are being spoken of here. They call them giants in the authorized version. Neanderthals were larger than humans. They had larger brain capacities than humans. It's interesting that we're the ones that survived the competition between human and Neanderthal. But it's obviously it's a function of God's grace. We had that spiritual spark within humankind that God had made promises to, had made a covenant with. And indeed, in this passage, we see another time that God comes to man and makes a covenant with Noah that he will not again destroy the earth with the flood. But he also gives to Noah the first law. And the first law is that man will be held accountable for the blood of man. So capital punishment at this point is instituted among mankind. He says if someone kills someone else, then their blood is required. So there is this very first law, this accountability. Interestingly, in this law of accountability, it's not just mankind that is held accountable, but it's also the animals. The animals are also said to be accountable for blood. That if an animal slays a man, then the animal is also has to give up his life. So there's an accountability here, not only of man, but of animals. And with this first law, There also comes the first dietary restrictions. You know, there one of the things that we see in Jewish tradition is the importance of dietary restrictions. And prior to Noah, man was apparently a vegetarian. At this point, in Noah's lifetime, after the flood, God says, eat meat. So, remember now, if you're a vegetarian, that before Noah, people were vegetarians, they lived 900 years. But also remember that when they were vegetarians, they were very, very bad people, and they had to all be destroyed. So, and God says, you've been too mean, start eating beef. So that's, and then of course, again, just to kind of do this quick compendium of the story, they land in the mountains of Ararat. They begin to establish life there, and the story goes on. Noah offers a sacrifice. The rainbow appears in the sky, and the story goes on to tell the nations, how the table of nations, when how the three sons of Noah spread out and their families became all the nations that were known on the earth. And that table of nations is one way we're able to date the story, because we know that it was around 1000 BC that we have nations like Ophir that are mentioned in that table of nations. In an interesting aside, in the medieval church, These things were taken extremely seriously. And when man began moving into sub-Saharan Africa, they discovered great apes. And the churchmen, the early missionaries in this region, were confused by the existence of great apes. They actually captured one and brought it to the Pope. And they said, is this human? Do we need to baptize it? And he looks at it and says, no, that's not human. Don't try to baptize gorillas. And then that gets repeated, interestingly, when they discover the Americas and they bring back a Native American. They bring it to the Pope and says, is he human? Do we need to baptize him? And then he says, yes. But the confusion was the Americas were not in the table of nations. So the question was, were they really descendants of Noah? Or the descendants of Noah, you know, from Adam? Were they human? And the Pope basically says, I don't know how they got there, but they're human, baptize them. So I'm glad that they decided that. Now, a couple of quick things to take a look at this passage. One is, I'm sure everybody has read stories or you've seen on YouTube videos where the ark has been discovered. Everybody seen that? I've looked at lots and lots of different stories of the discovery of the ark. Lots of different arks have been discovered. It seems to me like Noah must have had a fleet of ships that he was sailing around in. For the most part, I don't put a lot of stock in it. There is one photograph that was taken by an aerial reconnaissance plane back in the 1950s that looks pretty convincing. Of course, this is at the outset of the Cold War. It's right there on the Turkish-Russian border. We haven't had, you know, a lot of, there's not a lot of information coming from that since. But apparently they had this photograph, they sent an expedition up, they said there's this petrified boat up there. Maybe it's Noah's Ark. I don't know. But the photograph looks pretty good. It looks a lot like a big boat. It's like it should look like when you read the biblical story. But of course, the issue that most people want to ask is there really a flood? Was there ever really a flood? How could a flood have covered the entire earth? One thing to remember is when we talked about when God creates the heavens and the earth, earth does not mean the planet earth, because ancient man had no concept that this was a planet. The word earth really means a place for man. In fact, the Hebrew word for earth that we see in Genesis, where it says God created the heavens and the earth, is the same word they use for the nation of Israel today, Haaretz. Just means the land. Or probably a better way to connote its meaning is it's a place for man. God made a place for man. So there is this region in which humanity dwells, humanity lives, He's not spread over the entire earth at this point. And there is the story of a flood that kills all but just this one family. Now, what's interesting about that, if you read the mythologies of humankind, this story exists virtually everywhere in the world. We see this story in one version or another, not only obviously in the Middle East and in Europe, in India, in China, and even in the Americas. The fact that we can watch the dissemination of the story, we can figure out that this must have occurred somewhere around 50,000 BC. And the reason we know that is because tribes began moving into the Americas around 40,000 BC. From 40,000 to 12,000 BC is when there is the land bridge existed between what's now Russia and Alaska, and that's when the Native Americans made their way over here. So we're looking at a story that occurred right about 50,000 BC. And what really happened? We know that at the bottom of the Black Sea, there are lots of towns. There are villages, stone villages that we see at the base of the Black Sea. We haven't had a great deal of time to excavate most of those, but they must have been there for a very, very long time. At some point, apparently, the Dardanelles were closed, and it was the Dan River Valley that ran through what is now the Black Sea. That opened, and the entire region was flooded with waters. May have occurred about the same time the Straits of Gibraltar were opened. So man was probably living in these river valleys, because we have a very small population at 50,000 BC, when the waters open, you know, waterways open, everything gets rushed and flooded, and a very, very small number of humans survive. It's interesting, the tale of the salvation of animals, that God cares to save the animals and not just mankind. But that is, again, part of the stories that we see in a lot of other cultures. We see, particularly in India and China, we see that animals are also being saved, not just humans. Certainly in the Epic of Gilgamesh, where we have a flood story also, we see that not only man, but also his animals are being saved. So is this a true story? Absolutely. At some level, this reflects something that actually happened. It was a long time ago. And when you realize it doesn't have to cover the Himalayas, it's just wiping out this area that humans are living. But it was apparently enough water to have washed the Ark, if this is the Ark, on the mountains of Ararat, up to about 10,000 feet. That's pretty high, but tsunamis can do some amazing things. And you know, when you see that much water rushing through at once, it does move along. But what do we learn about this? Obviously, we learn that God cares to save mankind. God is looking out for man. However this event happened, whenever it happened, all the stories say the same thing, that there was someone that God called to be saved, and his livestock. And either through a boat or through the fleeing to a mountaintop, man was preserved. And God made a covenant with Noah not to do this again, not to destroy all of mankind again. And this had to be very, very key, very, very critical to early man to hear that, to know that God cared and God would not destroy them again. And then the one other thing we've seen again and again through these early chapters of Genesis, that the blessing is passed to the younger. It is Shem who receives the blessing. Not Ham, the older brother, but Shem, the younger brother. Again, the older will serve the younger. So because the Messiah is to come, the second Adam will rule over the first Adam. A couple of interesting notes. And I found this fascinating. I just saw this. You know, you read, every time you read the Bible, you see something new. And I just saw this just a few weeks ago. I was reading this particular story. And I see that you know, Moses sends out a dove, it comes back, sends out a raven, it comes back, sends out a dove again, keeps waiting 7 days, sends out a dove again. Noah. That's right, Noah. I say Moses, Noah. Thank you. For those on the tape, I mean Noah. It comes back with an olive branch in its mouth. And he sends out the dove one last time. The dove vanishes, doesn't come back. Where does the dove go?
We assume it went to land.
It went all the way to Mark chapter 1. Because when Christ was baptized, the Holy Spirit descended on him as a dove. Now, why doesn't the Holy Spirit descend on him like a fire or a wind or all of the other symbols of the Holy Spirit we have in the Scriptures? In fact, the dove is not a symbol of the Spirit that we particularly see in the Bible except for this one occasion. Because God is linking these two stories. That this baptism of Noah in the ark, through which the remnant of mankind was saved from the destruction of evil, brings us to the baptism of Jesus, which is the baptism we all share, to be saved from the destruction through the righteousness of Christ. So these two stories are inextricably linked. And that is why we read the Peter passage. Peter says, baptism saves you just like it did Noah. And the church adopted as their first symbol the anchor, the boat in the harbor at rest and in safety. For God has made in the church a place of safety for mankind.